You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's show, as Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan cracks down further following Friday's failed coup, we'll ask how much of the country will he soon have left to lead? My guests Jeffrey Kaufman and Rosemary Hollis will be debating this and the day's other top stories, including the latest findings on yesterday's train attack by an Afghan youth in Germany. We'll ask why the call of Islamic State appeals to troubled individuals. Plus,
point of order!
As factions of the Republican Party lock horns in Cleveland, we'll look at the divisive influence of Donald Trump. And we'll be marking Boris Johnson's first foray into public speaking as Foreign Secretary of the UK.
I'm afraid that there is such a rich thesaurus now of things that I've said that have been one way or another, through what alchemy I do not know, somehow misconstrued, that it would really take me too long to engage in a full global itinerary of apology to all concerned.
That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London, and Jeffrey Kaufman, an Emmy winning network television news and war correspondent, it says here. Jeffrey and Rosemary, welcome to you both. We begin today in Turkey, where the fallout from Friday's failed coup and the subsequent purge being led by President Erdogan is being felt in increasingly large sectors of the country. On top of the 6,000 military personnel, nearly 9,000 police officers, 3,000 judges and 30 governors are currently either suspended or detained. Today, Turkey's education ministry suspended 15,200 employees. That's in addition to demanding the resignation of 1,577 university deans. So, Rosemary Hollis, will President Erdogan have anyone left to lead?
Well, Turkey does have a very large population. And yes, I have been fascinated by the figures of the numbers of people being rounded up or dismissed from their jobs and so on. But this is the end of a fairly long story. And embedded within a lot of the state structures and systems of Turkey are supporters of the man, Fethullah Gulen, who used to be close buddies with President Erdogan and used to be his helper in clearing out opponents who stood so firmly for the Kemalist secular legacy of Turkey that they were uneasy about Erdogan and, at the time, Gulen's Islamist tendencies or propensity to take the country in a direction that meant more observance of a not very threatening form of Islam, but nonetheless a departure from secularism. Now, these two have fallen out, Gulen and Erdogan, and it would be no surprise if Gulen supporters weren't to be found in most institutions, including the armed forces, the judiciary, in the schools and so on. Gulen is dedicated to spreading education and had a lot of civil society institutions in addition to supporters within the state. So I think we should anticipate that the split within the Turkish establishment and society is very serious indeed, and ask ourselves, can Erdogan round up everybody, imprison everybody, without the thing coming apart at the seams?
Jeffrey Kaufman, I mean, here's the thing. It is, if you are Erdogan, and you believe that Fethullah Gulen is behind this coup, and you look at Turkey's history with the deep state, this idea that, you know, everything on the surface isn't always what it seems, then actually from your point of view, it does make sense to try and round up all the people that you feel are part of this movement that was behind the coup.
Let's step back for a moment, because I think that Gulen plays clearly into this equation. But what we have been seeing over the last number of years with Erdogan is a move away from democracy towards authoritarianism. He has what was the model, the single model, I would say, I would hasten to add, of democracy in the Muslim world, has now has under Erdogan drifted into this quasi-authoritarian state. We've seen and we've talked about around this table in the past, repression of journalists, arrest of journalists, freedom of speech. This is just the next step. You know, what motivated the coup is not completely clear, but what is clear is that he has divided society, that he is using his authority, his ego. And remember, this is a guy who people joke about it, but he's built this massive presidential palace that you know, Versailles pales against, all for his own ego and vanity. I mean, this is a man who think Vladimir Putin in Turkey. And so...
Yes, but we shouldn't confuse his opponents, including Gulen, with, you know, the good guys versus Erdogan, the bad guy, who's en route to becoming an oppressive dictator. And had the army only succeeded in this coup, or were Gulen to be in the place of Erdogan, it would all be all right. My impression is that that's not so.
No, I would agree with that. But I think that what we're seeing is a drift away from democracy. And you know, what's really worrisome about these arrests is that because Erdogan doesn't tolerate and doesn't tolerate critics, that he is able to use this. And it seems pretty clear, given the numbers we're seeing, that he is using it not just to get the perpetrators of the coup, but to sweep a much broader path and to pull in anyone who might be a critic of the
but
state.
How about the possibility that this was definitely the trend up until last Friday, but that he's overreaching himself now and it'll rebound on him?
Erdogan.
Yes.
I think we have to watch that, absolutely.
And for example, that wouldn't be the first time that Erdogan has perhaps overreached himself. He thought that he was going to be able to win such a whacking great majority at the election before last that he'd be able to change the constitution
to have a bigger presidency. Yes, and he's had to row back on his policies towards Russia and make amends because it's been too painful in terms of the sanctions that Russia imposed on Turkey. And he's seemingly rowing back on the stance that he was taking, the implacable stance that he was taking against Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So it's...
Which may or may not have contributed
to the
military decision to intervene.
Sorry?
Which may or may not have had some influence on why the military intervened, the changing of the stance
on
Syria.
Well, not directly.
The more opening up to Russia.
Personally, I don't think directly. I think Erdogan unleashed the military, having tamed them with the help of Gulen back in 2011. And that was when they effectively emasculated the armed forces that you referred to as the power behind the throne, the deep state. But then he unleashes the forces of the military again last year because he decides to go all out against Kurdish nationalism. And that is an operation conducted by the military. So for sure, I would think the senior echelons of the armed forces in the contemporary Turkish military have views about what is the right thing for Turkey vis-a-vis Kurds across the border in Syria and inside Turkey. But I'm not sure that I know whether or not they're exactly the same visions as had by Erdogan.
Well, go ahead.
Tifri Kaufman, there were... You could argue that this was a coup against, or was seen as a coup against, two different things. One was Erdogan and Erdogan's rule. Another was democracy. Now, the coup leaders say that it was about restoring democracy in that way that coup leaders always say their coups are for. But it's interesting that very quickly, far quicker than any foreign leaders, all the opposition parties, the democratic opposition parties in Turkey, condemned this coup. The coup leaders fired at the parliament as well. Again, that was seen as an attack on the parliament. In the coming weeks, do you think that distinction will remain important, that there was something against Erdogan, but yes, it was also against democracy?
I think Rosemary's right. I think that there are two trends to watch. Does Erdogan get to consolidate power, and does he become more authoritarian, or is there a pushback against him? And I think we don't know the answer. What is interesting out of all this is how does NATO walk this line? Because Turkey is a NATO nation, and John Kerry today has already warned Erdogan and said, it's fair enough, you had a coup, you have every right to reach out and arrest these people, but we're watching. Don't overstep. And this is going to put NATO in a really, really tight spot.
But does it, though? Because it's all very well John Kerry saying, we're watching, but Turkey's been a NATO member since 1952.
No. Erdogan is seemingly picking a fight with the states, actually. I mean, he's tempting them to say, you can no longer be a member of NATO. He is implicating the United States in the coup and suggesting that they had something to do with enabling Fethullah Gulen to instigate the coup. And there is some information coming out that suggests that maybe the coup was better planned and had a better chance of success than was initially apparent. I mean, there's one theory that it had to go ahead sooner than the plotters had intended because they foresaw that there was going to be a crackdown in a couple of weeks' time by Erdogan, and that they were suspects. But then actually this point that you've mentioned about the fact that the military attacked the parliament, that does seem to have been a key miscalculation. Mm. Another mishap from the point of view of the plotters, they raided the place where Erdogan was staying on his summer holidays 20 minutes after he'd left. Mm. And then the F-16s homed in on the plane that he was flying in to be informed, I understand from what's becoming available in the way of information, to be informed by the pilot of Erdogan's plane that it was a Turkish airplane. And the military didn't want to down a passenger jet or an innocent plane. So it's a fascinating story. And I think the most worrying message is that Turkey is unstable. Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey, I want to get back to this issue of the influence or otherwise that the West can have on Turkey. Because my view is it's often overplayed, the suggestion that somehow, you know, Turkey can be brought back into line by America, or that the carrot of EU membership will make Erdogan, the AK party, mollify them in some way. You know, this is the country that, you know, refused initially US jets to fly over during the Iraq war. They initially refused to take part in the coalition against ISIS unless it included attacking the PKK and the Kurds across the border as well. And as we've seen with the European Union, they are quite happy to strike a deal on refugees in return for a huge wad of cash. But it's this idea that somehow, you know, well, if you bring back the death penalty, you can kiss goodbye to EU membership, is going to matter to them, is nonsense, isn't it?
Turkey is a very interesting country, and if you look at the geography, a lot of it comes out of that, because it is the bridge of two continents, with Europe and Asia, and you have a cultural intersection that happens in Turkey, and very much explains why, on one hand, it is a Muslim country and it looks east. On the other hand, you know, its history of trade and commerce and culture also looks west, and so it is a country unlike any other. For that reason, it is also huge and influential, and does not want to be a puppet of either side, and so plays both, and has effectively, in recent years, done exactly that. Just what the West can do, I think it's fair to say that the EU membership is on the back burner after what's happened over the last couple of days.
Okay, we'll move.
Well,
on.
It wasn't very far at the
it
front.
It really was.
Well,
not
anyway.
According to Boris Johnson, no, though.
Indeed. Well, look, we'll move on and we'll get on to Boris a little bit later. Now, last night, an Afghan teenager attacked several passengers on a German passenger train, injuring four people with an axe and knife. Mohammed Riyad was killed by German security forces shortly after. Details are still emerging, and early reports claimed he had an Islamic State flag in his apartment. And today, a video from IS has appeared to confirm his connection to the group, showing the teenager saying he is, quote, an IS soldier. But as with previous attacks in Nice and Orlando, the line of command from Syria isn't clearly defined. Jeffrey Kaufman, we're in a new age now where terror attacks aren't necessarily planned in a top-down way, that you can have these attacks carried out by people who are inspired, if that's the right word, by an ideology, by leaders elsewhere. Does it really matter whether the person who carried out this attack in Germany and indeed others actually did take their orders from elsewhere?
Well, of course it matters because we need to understand the source and the origin. But I think what's complicated is that when you see this incident and the horrific incident in Nice last week, in which 84 people were plowed down by a man driving a refrigeration truck during the Bastille Day fireworks, there is, in both of these cases, it appears these were unhinged men, one very young, who were disenfranchised, bitter, whatever, but not directly taking orders. Nonetheless, the label of terrorist has quickly been attached to them. And on one level, you can understand it, but it does cloud, as you say, the issue. Are these people taking orders from some caliphate in Iraq, or are they in fact just watching social media and feeling, hey, I can get some headlines and die in a blaze of glory?
And if I could take it to another possibility here, these awful shootouts that we've witnessed to a lesser extent in Europe, to a greater extent in the United States, where some youngster arms himself with a couple of guns that exist in the family home and goes and lets loose on fellow pupils or students at a former college or children and teachers. And we're not, because that's not seen in the context of terrorism, we're not scraping through their personal effects to try and find out whether they were motivated by Islamic State or not. So clearly we have to be careful whether we actually hand an advantage to Islamic State.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very important point you make, that an 18-year-old who shoots and kills dozens of children of schoolmates in the U.S. is seen as an unhinged young man. An 18-year-old with Afghan or a 35-year-old Tunisian is seen as a terrorist, and there is a real, you know, very, very clear racial profiling going on when we see that kind of trend in the media and in politics. But let's be clear, it's really, really effective campaigning for certain kinds of politicians to do this. You don't see Barack Obama doing it, but you sure do see Donald Trump doing it, and you know, even the French politicians are doing it because they're afraid of Marine Le Pen. There is this sense of we need to arm ourselves. We need to up the war.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the backlash against Angela Merkel because she was the one that said they should all come to Germany. And now look what they
German
do.
Twitter is afire with racism and xenophobia today as a result of this stabbing by this boy who was 17 years old, came from Afghanistan just last year, was one of those people we saw in all of those news reports last year.
So I think we're agreed that this is stuff for exploitation by politicians and populist ones in particular. But then the next step is that we're told the solution is more bombing of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And so far, insofar as some progress has been made against Islamic State territory-wise, the repercussion has been more and more attacks, which, if we take the ones in Belgium and in Paris, we can attribute that to Islamic State. And it the answer is not even necessarily, in those cases, more bombing in Syria and Iraq, but certainly isn't in the case of Nice and now this young man
in
Germany.
Is there not an argument? You know, I can understand why someone would say, well, look, the answer to what happened in Nice and in Germany isn't necessarily more bombing in Syria and Iraq. But there is a separate case here, isn't there, Rosemary, that, you know, there are towns and cities in Iraq and in Syria that are being controlled by ISIS, where it is a living hell to be. And, you know, and if we have decided that we are going to try and stop that, then should we somehow not, because a 17-year-old Afghan has tried to attack...
We're not doing it for the sake of the people there. I'm talking about the spurious argument which says we'll make people safer in Britain or safer in France if we increase the bombing of the ISIS opponents of France and Britain overseas. It's not being done in order to make life better for the people who are stuck in Raqqa and stuck in Mosul, because we know that they have some very unpalatable choices in terms of who is the worst, but every bomb is bad news for those people. So it's not a rescue operation for those people.
Jeffrey Kaufman.
There is also another very complex and disturbing equation, and that is, how do Western leaders deal with these random attacks that simply can't be traced through intelligence? You know, when you have a man doing what he did in this man in Nice, who plowed down 84 people,
who wasn't known to intelligence agencies.
There was no phone chatter. He was a petty criminal. That's all. But he was not on any lists, any watch lists. This kind of activity, I think it's a consequence very directly of our deeply wired or wireless world of social media, et cetera, which just relentlessly tells us about these kind of things. And I believe plants these ideas in the minds of people and makes it so accessible. And also, I think, the temptation for glory. And the challenge is, when you have tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands on the beach in Nice watching the Bastille fireworks, how exactly are you going to protect them? Are you going to put up concrete barriers? Okay. Are you going to then put up searches, metal detectors? Okay. And where does that end? And exactly what events do you do it? And does every event of more than 50 people require this?
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. And we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House. We're back after this.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
We're going to end with a little visit to the world of international diplomacy. The UK's new Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, held his first official speaking engagement earlier today. He was joined by, I think it's fair to say, a master of the trade, John Kerry, and it didn't always make for comfortable viewing. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Thank you very much, Secretary of State. Can we go to, I think we've got a, sorry, it's your question now, John. It's a question from the US media.
Thank you. I have a question for each of you as well. First, Mr. Foreign Secretary, I have to follow up on my colleague's question because you didn't quite answer it. You've accused the current US President Barack Obama of harboring a part Kenyan's, quote, ancestral dislike for the British Empire, unquote, while claiming, I think untruthfully at the time, that he didn't want a Churchill bust in the White House. You've described a possible future US President Hillary Clinton as someone with, quote, dyed blonde hair and pouty lips and a steely blue stare, like a sadistic nurse in a mental hospital, unquote. You've also likened her to Lady Macbeth. Do you take these comments back?
Thank you for giving me an opportunity really to repeat a point that I made earlier on. I'm afraid that there is such a rich thesaurus now of things that I've said that have been one way or another, through what alchemy I do not know, somehow misconstrued, that it would really take me too long to engage in a full global itinerary of apology to all concerned.
Somehow misconstrued. Geoffrey Kaufman, I think this is the first time I've ever heard any journalist complain that their own work has been misquoted.
Oh, I'm sure I could find some other journalists, but this one's particularly entertaining and delicious. I mean, this is just... Theresa May knew this. She is no fool. She knew when she put him in the Foreign Secretary's office.
Wait. You say she's no fool. That's a foolish move then, isn't it? To have a man who's got to go around the world apologizing to everyone.
I think there are a lot of dots that she connected. This is a man who led the Brexit campaign. She had that. If she left him out, there would have been hell to pay.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Look, he is making this country look idiotic.
I don't think so.
And rude.
I think she's given foreign correspondents, foreign politicians, a golden opportunity to get their own back on this man. She's just hung him out to dry.
Yeah. No, she hasn't. She has made him Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, which last time I checked was an important job. This is the representative
to the world.
But
being Prime Minister is an important job, and she very shrewdly, she had no choice.
This is
she
not
had
shrewd. I'm sorry. I know you're the one supposed to have opinions on here.
Meant to be asking the questions. Excuse me. Could we speak?
This is not shrewd. This is dumb.
No, it's not, because dumb would have been to leave him outside the cabinet
room. Yeah, look at the way John Kerry handled him. It was magnificent. I think there's enough angry people out there who are going to take this opportunity, never mind whether they expect the British Foreign Secretary to be a somber, serious representative of important British interests. This is an exceptional moment, and she's put him out there, and he's got to take the flak. And he will either clean up his act or he will fail. And I think there will be a general cheering if they get their own back on this man. I don't think there was any better way for her to handle a very awkward situation.
Not giving him an important job.
No, because that would have made him more powerful.
To say...
Because then we would never have to actually test him. Now he's being tested. And let me, by the way,
Geoffrey, yeah. He was tested. He had 8 years as mayor of London.
Yes, but he led the Brexit campaign.
And then he led the Brexit campaign. He won his test.
But he won the Brexit campaign.
Spurious.
Yes, exactly. He lied, he manipulated, he dissembled. But he did. I think she's brilliant. Listen, she had no choice. But listen, the clip you didn't play was earlier in that news conference today, in which he absolutely, hilariously, inappropriately, ignorantly responds to some diplomatic niceties from John Kerry, and his ego is just fluffed beyond belief like a peacock, and John Kerry goes over and nudges him and says, it's called diplomacy, Boris. Now, I was a correspondent on American TV for almost 20 years. That kind of the Brexit is a hard sell on Americans for Americans. British politics, forget it. Except, you want to talk about the Queen's birthday, about Kate Middleton, okay. I would be very surprised if that moment doesn't make it on American Network TV tonight. They've got a new entertainment.
Geoffrey,
it's called Boris Johnson.
This is my point. If I were Prime Minister of this country, I would not want my Foreign Secretary to be entertainment on
US
TV.
Can I try it another way with you? It's not Britain that's being made a laughing stock. It's the Brexiters that are being made a laughing stock.
I would like to think you're right, but you're absolutely not.
Conspiracy. Oh, wait a minute.
I'm sorry.
Conspiracy theory here, and I think Rosemary and I would subscribe perhaps to the same one, although I'll let her speak for herself. I think this is a way to put the Brexiters out there, and the old Pottery Barn line: you break it, you own it. And that is,
Can I put something to you? Let's say, Boris Johnson, because he's not a fool. Let's say he sort of modifies his act, cleans himself up bit, does the job for 2 or 3 years, doesn't make any mistakes. And in two or three years' time, Theresa May is perhaps sort of lagging behind in the polls. Maybe Labour are doing slightly better. Who knows? That's probably never going to happen.
There are too many ifs going on here.
Sure. But suddenly, Boris
Johnson... And we're out of the European Union.
Sorry, Boris Johnson isn't joke figure who was mayor of London with a joke job for a bit. He's been foreign secretary.
There's nothing jokey about the mayor of London.
And he's beloved by the Tory party. He's surely going to be the next prime minister, Rosemary.
There are too many ifs.
Look, he was revealed in the leadership contest to be incapable of being prime minister. You had some senior figures in the Tory party saying, like Kenneth Clark, it would be absurd for Boris Johnson to be prime minister. And he is being allowed just enough rope to hang himself.
Okay.
And it's a very British practice at British public schools. You promote the troublemakers to junior prefects.
Fine.
And then see how you tame them.
Well, let's see how that works.
Well,
Rosemary Hollis and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both. That's it for Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Jacob Ladiner and Barclay Brown. The studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.